there's differences between the sexes. So men tend to lose more muscle mass because they have more muscle to start with, or lean mass. And then women tend to lose more fat. And so they kind of lump it all together in the results of those trials. Although I can tell you about the SURMOUNT-1 that the loss of the fat-free mass, which was measured when there was no structured strength training, was 10 to 15% for women and 20 to 25% for men.
Welcome to the GLP-1 Podcast Show, a monthly podcast where you'll find cutting-edge insights and all that's working in the world of metabolic health and obesity care. Our aspiration is to be the first place you are going to go to find out what's happening, the latest updates, and the latest research in GLP-1 science and clinical practice.
So hi, everyone. Welcome back to the GLP-1 podcast show hosted by Wisenetics. I'm your host, Arisha Moyes, a clinical researcher from McGill University. Over the past few years, we've been hearing a lot about the profound weight loss effects of GLP-1 receptor agonists. This was the topic of our previous conversations. But alongside that, there's also been increasing attention on how that weight is lost. So in particular, the loss of lean muscle mass in addition to the fat mass, which can be quite problematic when we think about strength, when we think about physical function and long-term health. So today I'm really excited to be joined here by Sandra Christensen, who is the founder and chief clinical officer of Integrative Medical Weight Management in Seattle, Washington. So Ms. Christensen is a master fellow of the Obesity Medicine Association and a fellow of the American Association of Nurse Practitioners. She serves on the board of trustees for the Obesity Medicine Association and is president of the Washington Obesity Society. She's also an associate editor of Obesity Pillars and author of A Clinician Guide to Discussing Obesity with Patients. She was named the 2022 Obesity Medicine Association Clinician of the Year Award and America's Top NP for 2024. So it's really a pleasure to have you here with us, Sandra. To start us off, we'll talk a little bit about body composition. So when patients lose weight on GLP-1 therapies, what do we actually see in terms of that?
Yeah, that's a good question, because what we see in clinical practice might be different than what's seen in research. And so when we start this discussion, we want to think about these three organs in the body, about body composition. We want to think about the adipocytes, or the adipose tissue, and the bone and the muscle. And they're all organs. They're all endocrine organs. They all emit hormones that communicate with other parts of the body as well as with each other. And so we also want to define terms. So we hear a lot about muscle loss with GLP-1s or muscle loss with weight loss. And that is part of it. But we want to separate what we call fat-free mass, which is also known as lean body mass. We're trying to use the term fat-free mass, from skeletal muscle mass, right? And not interchange those, because in that fat-free mass is bone, muscle, organs, fluids in the body, blood, all of that. And so when we think about what we know about the GLP-1s and their effect on reducing adiposity or reducing fat mass loss, we know that in both the STEP-1, which was the original trial for semaglutide for obesity, and SURMOUNT-1, which was the original trial for tirzepatide and obesity, they did post hoc analysis. And both trials showed that people lost more fat mass than fat-free mass. So that's the good news, right? And they measure that by DEXA, but what we don't know is how much of that is muscle and how much is not, right? So those are unanswered questions. They both looked at it a little bit differently. So it's hard to get really solid evidence about the amount from those two trials. So, and then in clinical practice, we see different results, right? Because there's a lot of variation.
Wisenetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access wisenetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
So you wouldn't be able to give me a number of what percentage is fat versus lean mass based off of the data that we currently have?
So I can give you that data. I've got it right here. I'm going to just look it up for us. So in the step one trial that I mentioned, the semaglutide for obesity, there was a 13.2% loss of the fat-free mass, with a 14.9% reduction in weight. And then in the SURMOUNT 1 trial, there was a 10.9% reduction in fat-free mass with a 20.9% reduction in weight. So for that step 1 trial, 45.2% of the weight that was lost was fat-free mass, whereas in the SURMOUNT 1, it was 25.7. So that was, you know, showing less with the tirzepatide.
Within this fat-free mass, we have muscle, we have bones, we have water mass. So we were not able to break that up into distinct categories with the DEXA results?
They did not report those. They did okay. not show those. Yeah. Yeah. It. This is like beginning where we're starting to look at this stuff better than we used to. And the thing is, too, that there's differences between the sexes. So men tend to lose more muscle mass because they have more muscle to start with, or lean mass. And then women tend to lose more fat. And so they kind of lump it all together in the results of those trials. Although I can tell you about the SURMOUNT 1 that the loss of the fat-free mass, which was measured when there was no structured strength training, was 10 to 15% for women and 20 to 25 for men. So that is consistent. And then the step one was about 20%.
Perfect. I really like that you brought up the differences between men and women, and I want to explore that a little bit later on. First, I just want to talk about these results. So in terms of other methods of weight loss, for example, through diet or exercise, are these numbers comparable to that, or are they more on the higher end?
They seem to be fairly comparable. In you know, there's a few papers where people have looked at that, and it seems to be pretty comparable. And what we don't know is there a specific effect of GLP-1s on fat-free mass, right? That's what we don't know, and in particular, bone and muscle.
Okay. So now that we recognize that this is happening, what can we actually do about it? What are the most effective strategies that you would use in your practice, or how you would advise your patients on how to really optimize and preserve or even improve that lean mass while on therapy?
Yeah, that's the best question of all, I think, is how do we do that?
It's a million-dollar question.
It is, isn't it? So the first thing I want to say is that we have some information, and we have to often utilize data from other populations, like maybe people with sarcopenia or maybe older adults. We don't have a lot of really good data on how do we optimize body composition specifically for humans that are taking GLP-1s to reduce their weight, right, that have obesity. So I think the most important thing before we even recommend any therapies is to get a baseline assessment of where people are at. And so if we can get a sense of what their body composition is, right? Their body fat percent, their lean body mass, or their fat-free mass, and then potentially bone, depending on the risk factors for folks, then we kind of know where we're starting. And that helps us determine how aggressive we're going to be with the GLP-1 therapy, right? So we don't want to induce rapid weight reduction in someone who maybe has sarcopenic obesity or dynapenic obesity or osteoporosis or osteopenia. And so getting that baseline can be helpful. Also want to assess their function, because that actually matters more in terms of muscle, is muscle function more than the mass. And so those are good places to start. And then once we, you know, have established where that person is at, what I recommend for people is eating a fairly high protein, low carbohydrate eating plan. Reason for that is because we know that protein builds and maintains both muscle and bone. What's good for muscle is good for bone. We have less information about bone, but we have more about muscle, but we know that what's good for one is good for the other, and they work well together. And then really making sure people get, you know, the micronutrients from vegetables and fruit, and really minimizing the sort of sweet, starchy alcohol category. Now, one of the challenges with GLP-1s is that they really suppress appetite and really decrease a person's interest in eating. And so that can be really challenging for people to get enough protein, right? And to get enough of the micronutrients. So you have to teach them to prioritize those foods at the beginning of their meals. So that's one way. Would you like to know the specifics of like how much protein that we're...
Yeah, of course. Sure.
So that's kind of, there's a lot of opinions on it. And we don't have any hard science on it. I tend to recommend, rather than going with the, you know, 0.8 to 1.8 grams of protein per kilogram of ideal body weight, kind of shoot for a target of like 90 to maybe 120 grams of protein divided up over the course of the day, to having people get it at least every 3 to 4 hours to improve that uptake of in the muscle and bone. But I really target it to, are we getting the results we want, right? Like if muscle is stable, bone is stable, losing body fat, have good function, whatever amount of protein they're getting is working.
So it's really personalized to each patient.
Very personalized. And I'll say this, you know, what I see with my patients when I recommend that eating is that they don't lose as much of the fat-free mass as they did in those trials because I'm monitoring closely.
Yeah. And how important is resistance training in this context?
So it's really important. That's the other thing that is also important is the resistance training. So people getting, you know, two or more sessions a week. And that's, again, good for bone, good for muscle. We also know that all three of these organs contribute to insulin sensitivity or insulin resistance in the body. And so resistance training as well as aerobic activity helps make a person more insulin sensitive. And so they all contribute. And then the little bit of data that we have shows that concurrent exercise, meaning a combination of resistance training and aerobic training, is even more beneficial in terms of muscle.
So are there specific patients who you're more cautious about body composition changes when starting therapy, or they're at a higher risk of adverse effects in changes in body composition?
Absolutely. So people that have osteopenia, and in particular osteoporosis, we know that a rapid weight reduction over the course of, you know, first 3-4 months of therapy can have a real detrimental effect on bone. So for those people, I want to go slower, right? And I want to really incorporate in the resistance training or the and or the protein with them and the aerobic activity. And I have just recently learned that there are some physical therapists out there who specialize in osteoporosis. Mm-hmm. And so I'll refer my patients to them so that they're getting really targeted exercises that are specific to, you know, individual for that person, but also that aren't going to put them at risk of a fall. And so that's one strategy. But sometimes I won't go up in a dose if I'm seeing more rapid weight loss with somebody. And I really encourage them to do that. And then you wind up in these clinical dilemmas sometimes where folks aren't necessarily doing that and you don't want to cause them harm. And so those are challenging situations, but but most people are able to do something. And if nothing else, the protein, right?
And you mentioned you really like to personalize it to each patient, and you look to establish sort of a baseline to see where everyone's at before we commence therapy. How often are you tracking the body composition, like in practice during the follow-ups, and what tools are you using to do this?
So I use a bioimpedance scale, and I do that at the beginning of treatment. And then I typically don't check it again for another 3 months. Because especially in the case of muscle, if somebody's trying to build their muscle or maintain their muscle, they can get discouraged if they see sooner, because it takes a while for that mm-hmm. to happen. I will do it sooner if they're curious about their body fat percent. I will also say, since we're discussing bone, that if somebody is at risk for osteoporosis or has osteoporosis, osteopenia, I want to send them for a DEXA for bone mineral density to kind of mm-hmm. see what our baseline is there. And then, you know, recheck that in 6 to 12 months to see, to make sure that we're not causing any issues. But I have to say, this is kind of new thinking. So I don't have a lot of long-term data, even just on my patients. You know, this is something I've been incorporating maybe in the last 6 to 8 months.
I guess I was thinking more from a practical standpoint, like what tools or metrics are most useful in routine clinical care, and in terms of access as well. Do clinicians have access to these scales? I know DEXA machines are super expensive, so it might not be realistic for everyone to get a scan.
Yeah. So there's two kinds of DEXAs. There's the one where you send somebody for either a screening or diagnostic for bone mineral density. And then we have these other DEXAs that are mostly used in research that can look at, you know, the fat and the distribution, as well as the lean mass, the fat-free mass. Many communities have those, and people can go pay out of pocket like $100, $150. That puts them out of reach of many people, but within reach of a substantial number of people as well. And so what I would focus on more, at least for muscle, would be on their physical function. You know, do they have any limitations? You can do the hand grip strength. You can do the chair stand test. You can do, you know, the 6-minute walk and kind of measure someone's function prior to them starting. But it is a challenge if you're out there in primary care or other settings and you don't have access to these nice machines.
I think this really highlights the importance of having proper monitoring when you're on these drugs as well. As they become more and more accessible and more patients or just individuals start to take them, I think we kind of lose sight of really the multidisciplinary care that goes into really optimizing their use and making sure they're safe. This muscle loss thing is a new issue, but there are a plethora of other side effects that I think we also need to monitor as well. So I think that's a great way to highlight that. And you touched on physical function and strength, which was going to be my next question. So now I want to go back a little bit to women specifically. So women, we have completely different landscape. We have various hormonal factors and life stages, perimenopausal women, postmenopausal women. So are there any unique considerations when prescribing GLP-1 therapies in women in different stages of life?
Yeah. So first of all, I have started getting like a bone mineral density DEXA scan on women at the beginning, you know, when they're early in perimenopause, or if they come to me, depending on what stage they're in, but way before they turn 65, because we lay down most of our bone by 25 to 30, all of our bone by 25 to 30. And then we start losing it at 1% a year. And then once start perimenopause, that accelerates. And so I want to get a baseline for them then. I will also say that when I do a history and do a body composition, that there's a fair number of younger women, even pre-perimenopause, but certainly perimenopause, who have what I diagnose as sarcopenic obesity. So they have low muscle mass and function and high body fat. And some of that can come if they've been involved in weight cycling, if they've, you know, had a lot of rapid weight loss and didn't do any exercise with it. So I find that group that I find that more often than not. We've had this belief for years that people who carry extra weight have lots of muscle mass and dense bones, but the truth is that's not true. They have, some do, but they have a lot more fat infiltration of bone and muscle that affects their function, and so they may not be as active. So that's one thing that I do. And then if somebody is having symptoms, vasomotor symptoms, genitourinary symptoms, or we determine they have osteopenia or osteoporosis, then I would refer them for consideration of some menopause hormone therapy. And that's one of the indications for the menopause hormone therapy is to build bone, maintain bone. So those are things that I'm a lot more proactive on. And then we also have this whole group of women, this 20-year cohort that were coming into perimenopause right when that Women's Health Initiative study came out and everybody stopped or, you know, were de-prescribing the hormones. And now they're, you know, in their 60s and some are beyond the age when we think it's optimal to start menopause hormone therapy. And so they're really at risk of both bone and muscle loss. And so that's a group that I screen and monitor very carefully.
So in those cases, would you still recommend that they commence GLP-1 therapy or would you put that on pause until?
I would put them on it with very close monitoring and really making sure that they're hitting their protein targets, that they're starting the GLP-1s, or excuse me, the resistance training and the aerobic training.
And how often are these patients seeing you, whether that's like telemedicine or in clinic?
Yeah, so I'm an obesity specialist, so I have the luxury of seeing people for this very thing. I'm not trying to squeeze it into a primary care practice. So initially, I'll see my patients weekly for the first 3 to 4 weeks, and then once every 2 weeks at a concierge-style practice. So I have the luxury of seeing them fairly frequently. And so that can be more challenging for people that are out there in primary care. I would say at the very least, if you can see them once a month, and more so at the beginning of therapy or whenever you do any dose increases, because so many people think that the goal of this med is to not eat, to not eat very much. And then you'll just lose all this weight and this will be so good for you. But it really isn't. And it's more of a challenge to get people to eat and to get them interested enough in eating. And in particular, you know, protein foods, they don't seem as interested in on the GLP-1s. And so you really, you know, once somebody's stable, you can certainly see them less frequently. I'll tell you a story a patient told me just yesterday. She was talking about how she wanted me to accelerate the titration of her medication, like even faster than what the manufacturers recommend. And she was telling me about someone she knew who just kept going up, 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 like every week or two with the dose, and how much weight this person has lost. It was fabulous. This person lost all this weight. I want that too. I said, who's prescribing this? Oh, some doctor, you know, far away, like telehealth that's not really monitoring. And, you know, like that's the very thing that we don't want because it's not going to be good. You're not going to have good outcomes with that, even if there's lots of weight loss.
Exactly. It's very problematic. And there are a lot of commercial health programs where you can get access to these drugs. In Canada, semaglutide actually went off patent in January. So the access has gone up because it's cheaper. So more people are on it. And I think it's very important to be mindful of the weight that you're losing, not just, you know, it's not just fat. It's all these other things that could have immense amount of effect on your physical function.
Correct. And we want to think about physical function now, but also in the future, right?
Exactly.
We don't want to cause a problem now. I mean, there's already so many age-associated changes in function that we don't want to accelerate those at all.
So my last question is about discontinuation. So I've heard that once these drugs are discontinued, it's very common for patients to regain back a bunch of the weight that they had previously lost. So is there any data on what exactly they're gaining back? Is it primarily fat mass, lean mass, or both? Is this problematic potentially?
That is a good question, and I don't think I know the answer to it. What I can't, you know, we have some data on weight cycling where when people, you know, lose, a lot of their muscle mass and lean mass, that when they regain, they gain more fat back and they don't regain that muscle. So the question is, would that be true with the GLP-1s? And I think a lot of that would depend on what the clinical progression was of that, right? Did they lose a bunch rapidly and lose a bunch of muscle? But to kind of look at this question in a bigger way is, there has been a lot of concern about the loss of muscle. And I think that's warranted. And I think we need to be paying attention to that. But I think that we're getting to a place where it's a lot more nuanced in that. The more I learn about this, the more I realize we don't know and you know, that we need more data. And so a big question is, when someone loses their, you know, a certain percent of muscle with their weight reduction, is that adaptive or maladaptive? Because when I see a patient that loses, let's just say 20% of their body weight and they lose 20% of their muscle, well, that's pretty proportional, right? Mm-hmm. And exactly. So as someone regains, that's the question, right? What do they regain? And we would expect that they would if they're off therapy.
Yeah, I guess we just don't know yet, right? Everything is new. There's a lot of questions that are coming up and people are curious. I was talking about this with my PI the other day, and we were discussing whether there's a window where resistance training might be particularly relevant after discontinuation, if we can kind of address the problem before it gets too bad. So there's a lot of interest in this area for sure.
Yeah, that's a really good thought. And the reasons people discontinue, you know, sometimes it's planned, but often unplanned, right? They don't have access to the meds anymore. And so if they have that sort of a sudden withdrawal from it, then would adding resistance training right away be beneficial? We would hope they would already be doing it, but, you know, the reality is maybe not.
I've also heard of clinical trials that are currently underway where they're combining GLP-1s with myostatin inhibitors to kind of help limit that loss of muscle mass. So it's a very exciting area, and there's a lot that's going to be coming out in the research world and in the clinical world very soon.
There is. And one more thing I'll say is that when I serve on advisory boards for companies that are developing obesity medications, and they ask, you know, what kind of things should we look for in our trials? I really bring up the body composition things. Like, we should know a lot more about bone. We should know a lot more about the fat-free mass, the skeletal muscle mass. We should know more about their function, which the trials, the Step 1 and Surmount 1, showed improved physical function in people after the weight reduction, but like some more specifics in that. And then also in terms of women and their hormonal changes over their lifetime, like premenopausal, perimenopausal, postmenopausal, and then those that might be on menopause hormone therapy. I think these are all really important questions to bring into those trials.
Well, thank you so much, Sandra, for sharing your insights today. It's very clearly very important and practical discussion, and it's an evolving area, so hopefully we will be getting some answers to our questions soon. But your perspective really highlighted how we can move beyond just the weight loss, right, to really think more holistically about patient outcomes, long-term outcomes. And to our listeners, thank you so much for tuning into the GLP-1 podcast show. If you enjoyed this episode, please remember to like, comment, and subscribe. Until next time, thank you so much for listening.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.